Once again, it's a delight to be with you, and it perhaps is perceived as obligatory on the guest speaker to say that, but I mean it. I cherish the church and am honored to for the invitation and thankful for the grace with which I've been treated. So I'd like this evening to talk, kind of return to what we were talking about this morning, and that is to a line of promises that Jesus made concerning his death. And they're all recorded in the book of John. And it's just fascinating to see how they come together. That is, how they come to pass, those promises. I'm going to take you to that in just a few minutes. But I want to kind of set the stage by talking for a few minutes about a theological reality. And that is the remarkable, inextricable, and bottomlessly important connection between real history and your faith. I don't know that it's as widely and carefully appreciated as it should be, that the faith of the Bible is grounded in real history. Now, think for a moment. That is very distinct from any other philosophy or pretender religion. That is, most philosophies, most religions are the function of some supposedly insightful man or woman who had great insights, maybe sat in a hill somewhere, maybe with a big tummy, who knows the world. But the point is that they had insights and metaphysical thoughts that if you somehow get in touch with these, that you'll be perhaps wafted to a greater level of consciousness or something like this, or there's some body of secret knowledge which you can be introduced to. None of that is testable. None of that is falsifiable. Now think about this. Christianity, Judeo-Christianity, the faith of the Bible, is grounded in all of its parts in real history. Your Bible, half of it is historical narrative. From Genesis to Nehemiah is a historical story. Now, that takes you as far forward as we're going to come in Old Testament history, and then there's another book, Esther, which is already a flashback. But from Genesis to Nehemiah is a historical record. From the four Gospels and the book of Acts are history. So about half of your Bible is historical record. Why is that? Well, listen, let's get real basic. If we are going to know God, God is going to have to take the initiative, right? We are twice crippled. Number one, we are finite, and so we cannot search out an infinite God. And number two, we are fallen, and therefore we're not only disinterested, we are fleeing. We are in rebellion against that God. So if God's going to make himself known to mankind, he's going to have to take the initiative. Praise his name, he has taken that initiative, and we call it revelation. What is, many of you know, don't be bashful, it's Sunday night. What's the Greek word for revelation? Anybody? Apocalypsis. We call the last book of the Bible the apocalypse, as in the four horsemen of. Well, what does apocalypse mean? It means revelation. I mean, it's translated. What does it mean in the Greek? It means an unveiling. And that's how you need to understand. God is unveiling himself. The formal definition, or a formal definition of revelation in a biblical sense, is God making known to man that which man could not discover for himself. Now, God has done that, but we have it recorded for us in the Scripture, but the point I want to make is this, that at every single stage when God has revealed himself, as recorded in the Scripture, he has always done it in two steps. And I want you to think construct for a moment. Think about it. God has always revealed himself in two stages. The first stage is what theologians historically have called event revelation. Now, that's God breaking into human history, really, genuinely. I like to say God perpendicularizes himself to human history, just breaks in, and you have the waters of the Red Sea parted, and several million Jewish people making their way across dry land. You have bread falling out of heaven. You have walls falling out at the sound of a trumpet. You have you have people being brought back from the dead. You have Jesus healing and so on. So those are, and by the way, the Bible calls those the mighty acts of God. Psalm 146 uses that phrase about three times. Celebrate the mighty acts of God when God breaks through into human history. Now that's real history. But that's never enough. If all we had was God breaking into human history, we wouldn't understand it. We'd get it wrong. So event revelation, that's the first stage, is always and ever followed by word revelation. So God raises up a spokesman. And in the Old Testament, we call that spokesman a prophet. In the New Testament, we call him an apostle. And the spokesman always had two duties, two stewardships. Number one, and this is huge, is to record the event revelation. So now we have a God-breathed, absolutely dependable record of God breaking into human history, right? But not only does he record that event or those events, that event revelation, but he interprets it for us. So now God explains, how well would you understand the gospel if you only had Matthew? Or to say that if you didn't have Romans. See what's going on there? And that's exactly what God has done. All throughout human history, he has taken the initiative. We would be absolutely bereft of any truth if he had not done that. But God has taken the initiative, and he's done it in two steps. First of all, always, event revelation, and then word revelation, recording and interpreting it. And that's what we have in the Bible. And so the point is that your faith is now grounded in real history. Now, one of the ramifications of that, and it's profound, it's important, is that the faith of Scripture is falsifiable. If it could be proven that those historical events were fiction, then our faith would be groundless. Now, Paul says this specifically about one all-important historical event, and that's the resurrection of Jesus. But, folks, that's a historical event. When Jesus came alive from the tomb on the third day after being slain on a Roman cross, we'll talk about it in just a few minutes, that resurrection is a real historical event. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, he's confronting those who insist that there is no hope beyond a grave, and he says if there's no resurrection, then Jesus is not raised. And if Jesus is not raised, what? Our faith is in vain. It all goes up in smoke. Now, do you understand, honest to goodness, maybe this seems a little esoteric, but it's hugely important. Your faith is grounded in real history. Now, let me enlarge on it just a little bit. Your faith is grounded in specific historical truth claims, the most important of which is that a Nazarene was slain by the Romans and arose from the dead 3 days later. Your faith is grounded in that. And you know, one of the I'm going to demand a little bit of you here, but one of the dynamics of that set of truth claims that we might as well come to grips with is that in many cases, those truth claims are a bit bizarre. I mean, the idea that Jesus of Nazareth arose from the dead after 3 days, that doesn't happen. Again, the idea that the waters parted in the Red Sea of the Jordan River, that doesn't happen. You've never seen that happen. You can't make that happen. Only that doesn't happen. So you have, think about it this way. You have invested the eternal safekeeping of your soul's spirit in a gospel which includes the Bible as a large, but as a whole, but then specifically the gospel story of Jesus. It's a set of historical truth claims which include historical events, purported events, which are really, really, they're not, it's a little bizarre to believe that. And let me take it a step further. Here is a curious reality about history. I think everybody in the room will agree with me about this. Most of it happened a long time ago. Can we all agree on that? So think about what this means. You have I'm going to say it again, invested the eternal safekeeping of your soul, spirit, and the very fact that you're here where you belong on a Sunday night would indicate that you've invested the focus of this life as well as the next into that Christianity, which is based on a set of historical truth claims, which happened a long, long time ago, and are on the face of it in many cases, rather bizarre. Why would you do that? Why would you believe that? You ever thought about that? Does it make any sense to believe the Bible? All right, now I'm not here to preach apologetics, and it would be way beyond my ken. But here's what I want you to understand. All right, I'm going to ask you a question. Talk with me, honest to goodness. If I were to make the claim that I have been doing some study, and I made the rather stunning discovery that Abraham Lincoln was not killed by gunshot, that in point of fact, the story got confused because Wilkes Booth did in fact burst into the balcony, but there was a melee of sorts or a scuffle, and Abraham Lincoln fell from the balcony and died of the fall. Now, that's not particularly important, but you wouldn't believe me, would you, if I just told you that? Talk to me. What would I have to convince you of it? Keep going. Proof. All right, what kind of proof? What is it? Eyewitness. You'd have to have more than one eyewitness. You'd have to have eyewitnesses that were their testimony, and this is big, their testimony was circulated at a time when there were still people who could put the lie to it. Now take that with you for a moment to the four Gospels. Folks, I'm taking you somewhere. We live in a day. I had lunch today with some dear friends who are part of this church and dear brothers and sisters, and we got to talking about this. And the fact is that we live in a day when, number one, the world tells us that all history is unknowable, that one man's guess about history is as good as the next. We can't give in to that, folks. We who have invested our lives in this book, we cannot for a moment allow the proposition, the ludicrous postmodern anti-rationalist proposition, that history is unknowable. Our faith is grounded in history. That makes sense to you? So number one, we got to come to grips with that. But here's what really concerns me. We live in a day when many evangelicals, many who are outstanding voices in defense of the Word of God, are willing to say, well, it's not important whether or not Joshua really destroyed Jericho. That may be a myth, but it teaches us that God is big enough to save. It's not important whether or not there really was. This is happening all over the place in the evangelical world. This is not some crazy liberal anti-supernaturalist. This is happening. And we're told it's not important whether or not there really was an Adam. There probably never was a man named Adam, a woman named Eve. That's probably not a real story. The important thing is that men are wicked. And it's just a story to teach us that. So we're told again and again that the truth that is communicated through the event is more important than the event itself. Or to say it another way, the event itself is expendable. Who cares? And I'm here to argue. I'm here to insist. We can't go there. And let me take you to the Gospels, because that's where we're seeing it today. Let's just think about the story of Jesus and his miracles and then his arrest and death and then his burial and then 3 days later, his resurrection. Of all the stories in the Bible, there's none that is more immediately... you know what it is? It's incredible. Now again, I may have told you this before, but I tell people all the time, I happen to think I am the only guy left in the human race in the English-speaking world who knows how to use the word incredible. So, because today incredible just means swell. So everything that happens is incredible. Well, okay, I understand where that comes from. It's too bad because you can't use the word the way it belongs to be or ought to be used. Incredible means unworthy of belief. So I say, I heard people say, oh, that was an incredible sermon. I think, well, would it have been just as would it have been just as good for the sermon to be credible? You know what I'm saying? I heard somebody talk about a court case, and they said, that man gave incredible testimony. Well, there you go. Throw it out. You know, it means it's unworthy of belief. And there is that about the story of Jesus which is superficially and intuitively incredible. Why should we believe that a man came alive from the tomb after 3 days of death? Well, you could say, and I there's an element of this, that the Spirit of God, but the Spirit of God brings you to that understanding. The Spirit of God never, ever asks you to leap into some abyss of silliness and irrationality in any sense. And in point of fact, the reason that we can have confidence in those historical truth claims is because we have eyewitness. Yea, verily, we have an abundance of eyewitness. Now, let's talk about it for just a minute. I will insist, and I don't think I'm going to get pushed back here, although I do in a lot of places, but we'll see. I will insist that the first gospel written, the first of the four, was Matthew. And every single scintilla of early church history evidence points to that. As a matter of fact, I make two comments about Matthew. Number one, it was probably written by about four, well, let me start with the other one. The early church fathers, all right, everybody on board with me? We have, in the first 300 years of church history, we have journals and letters and sermons and all sorts of literature from very important church fathers, we call them. These are the Anonicene fathers, the first 300 up to about 325, and their works have been collected, and it's rich and searchable and so on. So at any rate, it's interesting that the earliest church fathers, those who lived within a couple of hundred years or less of Jesus and the apostles, they remember Matthew as not only the work of Matthew, one of the 12, but as the collaborative remembrance of the 12. And you say, wait a minute, Bookman, do you mean 12? Probably 11. No, I mean 12. Go to Acts chapter 1. And by the way, I'm working against this, that there is a biblical mandate, and everybody in the room knows it by heart. I say mandate, there's a biblical canon or standard as to what renders a truth claim credible. Now, it's articulated that biblical canon is in biblical standard or rule. It's articulated in terms of jurisprudence of a courtroom and why you should believe a charge against a person, but I think it's perfectly applicable to historical truth claims. And what is that mandate? In the mouth of at least two and better three witnesses. What kind of witnesses are we talking about here? Eyewitnesses. So, biblically, what does it take to render credible a historical truth claim, even though it is on the face of it difficult to believe, a bit incredible? Well, you need two or three witnesses. And I think this is why Matthew is the first gospel. And you know what? It's the only gospel for better than 30 years. All the time that Paul was going across the Mediterranean world preaching the gospel, he had one book tucked up under his arm. And it was the book of Matthew. And it is the Magna Carta. It is the fundamental expression of this marvelous gospel story of Jesus. And everything else builds on that. But is it enough to have just one witness? Well, that's what I'm going to say. It's always remembered as the collaborative effort of all 12. And you say, wait a minute, what about Judas? Well, you remember that he was replaced. Go to Acts 1. And this is really instructive to me. Are you with me at all? Stay with me. In Acts chapter 1, as Peter, amazingly enough, and this is why John 21 is appended to the book to explain how it is that Peter steps into this position of leadership, but Peter stands up and he's going to give leadership in choosing a replacement for Judas. Not because Judas had died, but because Judas had apostatized. He had surrendered his spot, and so now they're going to choose a 12th apostle. I say that because there is the notion that all the apostles were replaced when they died. That's not so. There were 12, and there could only be 12, but there were some, all right, I better not go down that road, but there were the 12 who were going to sit over the 12 tribes, and Peter is overseeing the selection of one who would replace Judas. But I want you to look at verse 21. These are the requirements that Peter lays down. Therefore, of these men who have accompanied us all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out among us, beginning from the baptism of John to that day when he was taken up from us, one of these must become a witness with us of his resurrection. Now think about what this means. Peter says that we need somebody else who can bear witness to the resurrection. But it must be somebody who has gone with us all throughout the years since the baptism of John, who has known Jesus well. Why do you think that is? Well, think. If I had only come to faith after the resurrection, if I had only encountered the Nazarene after he had resurrected from the dead, could I give absolutely unassailable witness to the reality of his resurrection? He could be an imposter. It had to be somebody who knew him so well that there was absolutely no possibility that that witness could be deceived about the fact that this is the Nazarene. And we know that he died because he died on a Roman cross. I'm going to come to that in a minute. And now he's alive again. You know, and part of the problem that we have here when we try and think this through as far as antiquity and what was going on back there is we fall prey to this hubris of modernity, you know, where we think we're so clever, we're so critical, we're so scientific, and those people, they were all rubes. They were all so pre-critical, and you know, if you told them, hey, I had a friend, he died, or no, if you said, hey, you know what, I died a few days ago, and I came back from life, he'd say, oh, that's nice, let's have lunch, for heaven's sake. Look, people were just as skeptical back then as they are today. People don't come back from the dead, folks. They don't. They didn't then. They don't now. And so I say, think about this. If I were living in Nazareth, say I had lived my life as most people did. Most people lived their whole lives in the village where they were born. I'd lived there my whole life. And I had known this man. As a matter of fact, I had known the boy. I knew Mary and Joseph. I could remember when they returned and settled in with that little boy, and then Mary had several other children, and I could remember perhaps when somewhere along the line they had said goodbye to their father, to Jesus, to his adopted father, because it's quite clear that somehow Joseph died and Jesus stepped into the role of elder brother. But now I can remember Jesus maybe as a boy. I'm about the same age, and I remember when we would go to synagogue school to the Beit Midrash day after day, and he was hard on the curve, you know, but he was just one of the boys in town there. And I can remember when he apprenticed as a stonemason. I love carpentry, but he was a stonemason. I mean, the word carpenter that's used of Joseph is tekton, and it means builder. And you don't build with wood in Israel. There's no wood, so you build with stone. So almost certainly Jesus was a stonemason. He would have apprenticed with his adopted father Joseph for many years. Maybe I can remember when Jesus had taken his siblings and apprenticed them as stonemasons and so on. In other words, I had known this family. I had known this man, Jesus, this boy, this young man, this man, Jesus, all of his life. Now, a couple of years ago, he did a strange thing. You don't do this much in that culture. He left his village of Nazareth, and he moved his family to Capernaum. And then I heard about all the... And then I heard that he had gone and gotten himself crucified at the hands of the Romans. And now comes the day... I'm making this up in all of its parts. But now comes the day when, during those 40 days of resurrection ministry, Jesus, doesn't say this explicitly in the Bible, but allow me my imagination, he shows up here in Nazareth. What am I doing? How would you handle it? Would you say, oh, Jesus, you're back from the dead? That's great. That's wonderful. Folks, this is the way I'd handle it. I'd say, you know, if he walked up and I'd say, you really look like Jesus. This is eerie. you really look like Jesus. But Jesus died on a cross. And I'd have said something like this, honest to goodness. I'd have said, all right, let me ask you something. Remember that boy that lived down the street from you? And he was climbing in that tree right there, and he fell down and broke his arm. What was that boy's name? Honest to goodness, wouldn't you? Folks, people are not just going to say, oh, he's back from the dead, good enough for us. It's going to take, and that's what it's saying. We have to have somebody who has gone with us in and out and knew Jesus so well that when Jesus came back from the dead, he knew it had to be the Nazarene. This is not a counterfeit. This is not a trick. This is the Nazarene. Does that make sense to you? That's why Peter says it has to be somebody who has gone in and out with us from the baptism of John in order that he might witness to the resurrection. Now, does that make any sense to you? What I'm saying to you is that this business, your faith is grounded in historical reality, claims, truth claims. Those truth claims in many, many cases, they lay claim to very, very difficult to believe events and so on. Why should we believe them? And I would argue that God took very careful steps to render them historically credible in that generation so that every generation thereafter could take confidence. It's the generation who sees the event that has to verify it. All right, so see if I can make this make sense to you. I would argue, and most this is not unique to me at all, that Matthew was written probably by about 44 A.D. It was the first gospel written. And it was probably written by about 44 A.D. Now, most everybody will put it about 50 A.D. I'm going to back it up for this reason, that, as I say, the earliest witnesses remembered as a collaborative effort of the 12 apostles, and in Acts chapter 12, which happens in 44 A.D., around the persecution, first of all, when James is killed, and then when Peter is arrested, remember this, by Herod Agrippa, and the apostles begin to scatter all over the Mediterranean world. Well, this is a day well before internet and communication, so if you're going to collaborate, you're going to have to do it in the same rooms. That make sense to you? And the apostles begin to scatter by about 44 A.D. So, A, early Christians understand Matthew to be not just one lone voice, but the collaborative voice of the 12 apostles, and they begin to scatter about 44 A.D., so let's just run with it for a minute. And if you want to take it to 50, which is far back as anybody else takes it, that's fine, as if they go with Matthean priority, which they should. All right. The standard explanation is that, or the standard claim is that Matthew wasn't written until around 90, maybe 100 A.D. Now, folks, here's where I got to come back to me. Think about what that means. If it's not written until 60, 70 years after Jesus has ascended to the Father, there are no but the generation that witnessed the miracles are gone. But what about if the book of Matthew is written and circulated by about 44 A.D.? So when various preachers, whatever, apostles, make their way to this or that village, when they come back to Jerusalem and they got the book of Matthew and they read those stories, there are still thousands and thousands of people alive who can bear witness to either the truth or the falsity and would of those stories. That make sense to you? Here, one of the explanations of the feeding of the 5,000, it's rather popular, you'll run into it not infrequently among the critical crowd, is that what really happened was that Jesus made his way across the lake to Plain of Bethsaida, and a lot of people followed him. He was the best show in town, and it got late in the day, and Jesus said, feed him. Well, we can't feed him. What are we going to do? And a little boy came and said, well, I have my lunch. It's just 5 loaves and 2 fishes, but I'd be glad to share it. Now, here's the standard explanation among the critics, that probably what really happened was that everybody else in the crowd, or a number of other people in the crowd, said, well, I wasn't going to say anything, but I brought my lunch too. So they got theirs out. They were so moved by the generosity of this little boy. And so by the time they all shared all their lunches, there was plenty to go around, and it was a happy day, and everybody had plenty and picked up some extras. All right. That may work if the story is not written down and told until three or four generations later. But what about if Matthew is read up in Galilee at a time when most of those 5,000 people are still alive? And if all that happened that day was that we all shared our lunch and it was a happy day, and now you read this story that says Jesus miraculously multiplied those 5 loaves and 2 fishes, you got thousands of people who are going to say, come on, I was there that day, it was a nice day, give me a break, what's the miracle stuff? Does that make sense to you? Honest to goodness, you have invested your faith in a set of truth claims which are radically incredible and which happened a long time ago. Do you see how important it is for you to understand how important it is that that record was written down, and this is every scintilla of historical evidence demonstrates this. That record was written down at a time when, and circulated at a time when there were thousands and thousands of people who could have and would have put the lie to it if it was a fable. Does that make sense to you? As a matter of fact, by the way, there's another dynamic here, and that is that record was circulated at a time when there was a whole community of unbelieving Jewish leaders who were rabid to discredit it and would have scrutinized every detail. And we have a tremendous body of Jewish literature from that time, and there is never the first hint of a question or a denial of any historical claim of the Gospels. One of the specific elements of the New Testament that really is dramatic in that regard is the genealogies. The curious reality is that you have two genealogies of Jesus, one in Matthew, one in Luke. Matthew's is, in fact, the genealogy of Joseph and traces Jesus to David through Solomon. Luke's is the genealogy of Mary and traces Jesus to David through Nathan. Now, here's the point. Any messianic claimant has got to be able to demonstrate that he is Davidic. Jesus is twice Davidic. And now, by the way, time out. Largely because of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD by the Romans, but we don't have the records. The records are gone to verify that, but we know dead sure that those records were still available in the first century. And if there was the slightest flaw in those genealogies, the unbelieving Jewish community would have been all over it because it would discredit Jesus' claim to be Messiah. Never, never do they challenge those genealogies. Does that make sense to you? Honest to goodness, folks, here's where I'm taking you. Your faith is grounded in history. Those historic, now by the way, all right, why should we believe those historical truth claims? Well, there are reasonable, testable, universally received canons or standards according to which you test historical truth claims and historical records. By every one of those canons, these four gospels are absolutely unassailable. They were written by eyewitnesses. They were circulated. And I should say, Matthew is the first one, and then the second one written is probably, I think, Luke. Luke was not an eyewitness, but he makes a big deal of the point in his prologue that he went about and interviewed eyewitnesses. Remember when Paul was a prisoner in Caesarea Maritima for 2 years, Acts 21 to 26? Remember this, before he was sent off to Rome? And I think during those 2 years there in Caesarea Maritima, he'd been arrested up in Jerusalem at the end of his third missionary journey, and he'd been brought down here for protection, and he was being kept in the beautiful palace there because he was a Roman citizen, but he had 2 years. And I think it was probably during those 2 years, and those years were about 59 to 60 AD, that Paul sent Luke up into the hills to interview various people. And under Paul's careful oversight and under ultimately the superintending ministry of the Spirit of God that we call inspiration, Luke pens a gospel. And he's not an eyewitness, but he is everything he does. He's a careful historian, and he interviews the people who were involved. And then Mark is basically Peter's telling of the gospel. Peter was an eyewitness. And, of course, John writes late, as we talked about this morning, but he's an eyewitness. He's the last living eyewitness. So The record, I'm going to go back to my question that I asked before you. Why should we believe these stories? Well, I'm not going to take anything away from the Spirit of God. But the Spirit of God has preserved for us four witnesses. And when you think of the four Gospels, it's a fourfold gospel. There are four men, Matthew primary to his gospel, who are telling the same story. And it's all under this ministry of the Spirit of God. But in point of fact, here's where I'm taking you. The four Gospels. And by the way, let me say one other thing. Some people are really troubled over the fact that there are some differences of perspective and detail and so on in the four Gospels. Well, if you had four witnesses to a crime, for instance, well, let's say there was an accident, and you had four witnesses, and you called them each in independently, and they all told exactly the same story in exactly the same order with exactly the same detail, what would you assume? Collusion. They got together and agreed on that story. The synoptic, the fact that the Gospels are at once so similar in that they say the same story and so on, but so distinct in their detail, that's hugely important to the veracity and the dependability of those as historical records. I have come to the persuasion of late, I'm going to take you to the Bible right now here, so if I've lost you, be patient with me. But I've come to the, I really think Acts 1:8 is more an apologetic methodology than a missionary methodology. You'll go, first of all, you'll be witnesses to me first in Jerusalem and Judea and even Samaria, and only then to the uttermost parts of the world. Why? Because that's where these stories are falsifiable. And it's by reason of the fact that those stories were told in the very place where they were where they happened, at a time when there were still tens of thousands of people who were alive when those stories happened and could put the lie to them if they were but myth and fable, as we're told by so many today, rendered them historically unassailable. And now, as it spread across the world, their veracity was a function of the fact that they had been tested in a place where they were liable to falsification. Now, that's kind of heavy, but I'm telling you, let me take you now to John's gospel. And there's one element of Jesus' ministry that, well, of Jesus' death that I want to focus on. There are three times. All right, I'm going to tie these two thoughts together before we're done. But go with me, if you will. First of all, to John chapter 3. Listen, you will perhaps, matter of fact, here's a New Testament Bible quiz. There are three times in Jesus' ministry, all recorded, interestingly enough, in the Gospel of John, when Jesus speaks of being lifted up. Can you remember these? Well, you may have some passages banging around your head. The first one is John 3 and verse 14. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. This is part of the dialogue with Nicodemus there in Jerusalem. And early on in his ministry, Jesus speaks of being lifted up. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. What did he mean by that? Well, the next one is in John 8. Now, we've fast-forwarded almost 3 years, and we are at the Feast of Tabernacles. It is just about 6 months before it's late fall, 32 AD. Jesus is going to die in 33 AD, April of 33 AD. But now in John chapter 8, Jesus is contesting with the Pharisees, his enemies, and they have accused him of speaking on his own authority. You're not speaking for the Father. You're not speaking with any authority. You're making it up. And so Jesus says, John 8 and verse 28, when you lift up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he and that I do nothing of myself, but as my Father taught me, I speak these things. So he's saying, when you lift me up, then you will know that I speak for my Father. And the third time is John chapter 12. And this is probably on Tuesday of the Passion Week. It's a fascinating event. I'd love to stop on it, but I'm only going to pick one verse out. This is where the Greeks, the Gentile proselytes, had come and asked to speak with Jesus, and Jesus does speak with them. But he says to them in verse 32, I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. So Jesus has spoken three times. First of all, in John 3 to Nicodemus, as Moses lifted, so the Son of Man must be lifted up. And then to the Pharisees, when you lift me up, you'll know for dead sure that I'm speaking for the Father. And now he says, curiously enough, I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. Now I have heard, and I think, frankly, I'm going to be bold here, it's a bit careless. I have heard this used as if it means to glorify Jesus, to exalt him, to honor him. So if we lift up his name, then he'll draw. Well, there may be some truth in that proposition, but that's not what Jesus is talking about. And I can prove it to you because look at the next verse. That is in John chapter 12. I'm going to read to you again. Verse 32, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself. And then John the apostle gives us a staggering insight. He says, this he said, signifying by what death? And literally the tupos to star, the thanatou, the type of death he must die. So when Jesus said again and again that it was imperative that he be lifted up, he was talking about dying by Roman crucifixion. And I'll show you that because go now to John 18. And this is the passage we contemplated. I went by it very quickly this morning. But in John chapter 18, again, now it's about 4:30 in the morning. Jesus has been interrogated by the priestly, by the high priest and the Sanhedrinists, and he's confessed that he is the Christ. And so now they're bringing him to Pilate. And as we said this morning, when he is first brought to Pilate, Pilate says, what's the charge? And Jesus' accusers say, look, if he weren't a malefactor, we wouldn't have brought him. Just crucify him. And Pilate says, I'm not going to do that. You crucify him. And they give this remarkable confession. Verse 31, Pilate said to them, you take him and judge him according to your law. And therefore the Jewish leadership said to him, it is not lawful for us to put anyone to death. Now that's a staggering that's a staggering admission because it demonstrates that this was not a trial, it was a lynching. They weren't there to try Jesus to determine his guilt or innocence. They were there to put him to death, and they make that clear. But what I want you to see is verse 32, where John says that this happened in order that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. Does that make sense to you? So three times Jesus says, it's imperative that he die by being lifted up. Even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. When I am lifted up, you will know that I'm speaking for the Father. And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, I will draw men to myself. And then John says, when he said that, he was talking about the type of death he would die. And now when Jesus is hauled by the Sanhedrinists to Pilate, and Pilate says, you go try him according to your law, they say, you know we can't put him to death. And John says, and this was done in fulfillment of what he had said according to the type of death he would die. Now let me just take a couple of minutes. We're going to be done early. But let me take just a couple of minutes and walk you through what's behind this. I mentioned this morning that Roman officers had two responsibilities, collect the taxes, keep the peace. That became a hideous boiling pot for Pilate in the days of Jesus because of Jesus' wild popularity. And might I say that, and this is one of the aspects of Jesus' life that I most enjoy tracing and studying. Jesus told his disciples in Matthew 10 and verse 16 in that marvelous commission that he gave the 12 after he'd spent a night in prayer and then chosen the 12, and then he gave them that commission in Matthew 10, and one of the verses, verse 16, he says to them, you must be as wise as serpents and harmless as doves. An interesting verse. This is what he says. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves, and therefore you must be as wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And when we read that, it sounds like it's because, in other words, the reasoning is because you are going as sheep in the midst of wolves, therefore you must be as wise as serpent. But that's really not what the Greek says. What the Greek says is this, and it couldn't be more clear. I'm the one sending you. And because you go in my name, now you're going as sheep in the midst of wolves, but you are going to represent who I am. And therefore, if you're going to reflect who I am, you must be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And Jesus was that. He was blindingly clever. And this is another one of those places where you have to be so careful and deliberate to acknowledge Jesus' real humanity and so on. He had the plan. He had the scheme. He was so good at it and so clever. But having said all that, the point is that Jesus contrived to make sure that he would not die at the hands of the Jews, but at the hands of the Romans. And I could trace, it has to do with the two cleansings of the temple. You know what, that first cleansing of the temple, the very beginning of his ministry, Jesus absolutely, and this was deliberate, it was clever, he catapulted himself into notoriety. There was, Passover, this is the first, this is John 2, this is the very beginning of his ministry, and Jesus goes to the temple for the Passover, and he takes a cord and drives out the money changers and takes control of the temple for a short while. Well, Passover is a pilgrimage feast. There were people from all over the world. They despised what went on in the temple, but they couldn't do anything about it with the priests making merchandise of the worshipers and the money changers with their usurious rates and the car. The common man despised it. And when that crazy Nazarene took a cord and cleansed out that viper's nest for a few blessed hours, the next morning everybody got in a bus and went home. And what do you think they were talking about? And that quick, Jesus' name was on every Jewish lip in the wide world, practically. That was deliberate. And Jesus very deliberately, number one, catapulted himself into notoriety. But by the same token, the responsibility of the Roman authority was to keep the peace. Jesus became so wildly popular that whereas his enemies, first of all Jewish and then Roman, might have just sneaked into his wherever he was staying and hauled him off and stoned him. All right, let's say it this way. Many times the Jews wanted to stone him, but the Bible says they could not because they feared the multitude. And many times the Romans wanted to capture him, but it says they could not because there would be a riot among the people. Now, this is heavy stuff, and it traces all through Jesus' ministry. But what I'm saying is this, that, all right, let me ask it this way. How might we have expected Jesus to die? He came to the Jews. He angered the Jewish authorities. We might have expected him to die by stoning. But Jesus says, I'm going to remind you again, he says it again and again. He says it three times. That it was important that he be lifted up. And John tells us that what he meant by that was he was talking about the kind of death he would die. And when Jesus is brought by the Jewish authorities to Pilate, and Pilate says, you go put him to death, they say, you know very well, we can't do it. You know what? Time out. There's a big discussion as to were the Jews allowed capital punishment by the Romans? And there is every evidence that they were not, especially in Judea. But you tell me, what's the problem with that? What do we stumble over? If the Jews were not allowed to put people to death, what are we going to do with? I hear it? Stephen. I bet Stephen wished they'd have been a little more sensitive to that protocol. You know what I'm saying? Stephen was a nobody. And again, the Roman authorities were just trying to keep a lid on things. And if there's some nobody, he's a Baptist deacon, for heaven's sake, but if there's just some nobody, that works in some crowds. But the point is, if he's just, he's a nobody. And you want to haul him behind a house somewhere and stone him, for heaven's sakes, just keep a lid on it. Jesus is so wildly popular that they are rightly convinced that if they try that with Jesus, there's going to be a riot. If there's a riot, the Romans are going to have to send soldiers. If they have to send soldiers, they're going to figure out who sparked this riot, and their heads are going to roll. So I'm coming way back to it. Jesus was wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove, and he contrived to make sure that he was so wildly popular that his enemies could not take him, and so they had to look to the Romans. And that's exactly the point when it says that when Jesus was brought by the Jewish authorities to Pontius Pilate, John says this happened in order it might be fulfilled what Jesus said concerning the type of death he would die. So here's my point. Here's where I'm taking you. Biblically, there's no doubt. Jesus says that it was important that he die by being lifted up, and that referred to crucifixion. We're told explicitly by John that that's what he was talking about, and we're told that it was by reason of his popularity and so on that the Jews had to bring him, the Jewish authority had to bring him to the Romans, and that fulfilled that. So Jesus was careful to die by crucifixion. And furthermore, he had said, not only must the Son of Man, John 3:14, but when I am lifted up, then you will not be able to deny that I speak for the Father. And if I be lifted up, then I will draw all people to myself. Why is that? Well, let me just warn you, the Bible doesn't say specifically. But I think this is the point, and this is what's going to take us all the way around full circle to what I said before, what I was talking before about this importance of real history. The fact is that, all right, let's ask the question, why was it so imperative that Jesus die by crucifixion rather than by stoning at the hands of the Romans as a condemned, not a condemned, actually an exonerated, but die the death of a seditionist as opposed to simply being hauled out like a Stephen would and stoned to death behind a house somewhere? Well, I think to get to the bottom of that, we have to understand something about Roman crucifixion. And we know a great deal about Roman crucifixion, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time with it. None of it is pleasant. But you need to understand that Rome had taken a form of execution that was standard and had been around in every, especially tyrannical culture for a long time, but they fine-tuned it. They refined it very carefully. Because for the Romans, crucifixion, and it was an instrument of putting down sedition, and crucifixion was not about executing the seditionist. It got that done, but that's not what was at stake. Crucifixion was about putting down the sedition. It was a gruesome, cruel, unspeakably cruel, extended object lesson that had to be public so that whatever seditious impulse might be broiling in your heart would be put to rest. That make sense to you? Now, for that reason, Rome, and this is my construct, but I can demonstrate it. I think it's perfectly fair. Rome made four basic demands concerning crucifixion. When a man was crucified, these four realities had to be there. Number one, it had to be cruel. And frankly, it was cruel almost beyond our imagining. But the reason was that, again, it was to be a deterrent. And this is why, now, Jesus' scourging was different. But it was a standard practice to scourge a man before he was crucified. But it was a delicate, almost surgical crucifixion. Scourging. Because the second demand that Roman made, it had to be cruel. Secondly, it had to be lingering. They insisted that the man linger on the cross for at least a day. And so they didn't want to debilitate him horribly before they put him up there. So normally the scourging would be rather careful because what they wanted to do was open deep wounds laterally all across the backside. Because on the cross, as soon as a victim was placed on a cross, within minutes his rib cage would settle in on his breathing apparatus and you couldn't breathe. So you had to hoist yourself up. As a matter of fact, most victims died of suffocation. You couldn't sleep, you couldn't pass out, because every time you took a breath, you had to hoist yourself up, because you could. And so this is why, if you wanted to hasten the man's death, you would break his leg. And the point is that you've got these lacerations across your back, and every time you hoist yourself up, that's a rough timber, and those splinters are going to thrust themselves into those sores and so on, and the poor victim is going to cry out in excruciating, enduring pain and so on. And that's the point. They want it to be awfully cruel. They want it to be lingering. There were always apparatus of one sort built in so that he could, in fact, hoist himself up. He had to be able to hoist himself up. Thirdly, they wanted it to be public. And by that I mean it was always at a city gate, because in that culture, the traffic is going to be bottlenecked into that gate. You've got to go through the gate. There aren't very many. And it would be outside of a city gate on a low rise, not a big hill, but just a low rise, because they wanted the victim high enough that you couldn't escape. You were going to see it. You couldn't get lost in the crowd. You might take your kids and wrap your skirts about them and muffle their ears and hustle through as far away as you could on the far side of the gate, but you're going to see and hear that poor wretch as he cries out in terror. But fourthly, and this is the big one, Rome demanded that it be cruel, that it be lingering, that it be public, but above all else, it had to be absolutely certifiable. In other words, and the issue here is this, and this is why I introduced it the way I did. Rome would not tolerate the possibility that the rumor would get out that somehow this seditionist had survived the horrible ordeal, and so the sedition can go on. And he had to die on the cross. And there had to be, of course, this is the spear and the blood and the water, there had to be physical, visible evidence of his death on the cross. Because again, they would not tolerate the possibility that anybody would think that he had survived it. And by the way, the point is not that you had to be there that afternoon to see the blood and the water. When you heard in that culture, anywhere in the world, that a man had died on a Roman cross, you knew. You knew because of the universal and absolutely basic demands made of crucifixion, you knew that that man did not come down until he was genuinely dead. And by the way, I've read where if a man was inadvertently, carelessly taken from the cross, and as he lay on the ground, there was the last hint of life, just the flutter of an eyelid, and then he died on the ground, every soldier, every Roman soldier assigned to that detail was immediately put in a cross. That's how serious they were. That the man had to die on the cross. If I be lifted up, then you'll know that I'm speaking for the Father. When I am lifted up, then I will draw men. Why? Folks, and here I'm back to it, the reality of genuine, verifiable history. Jesus contrived to make sure that he would die at the hands of the Romans, a death far more awful than anything we can imagine. I think, fair to say, far more awful than stoning, which was, by the way, designed to be humane. But the fact is, Jesus contrived to die in that way so that, you see, because stoning could be botched. I mean, we have the story in Acts 14 of Paul who stoned in Lystra, and it says he was stoned and he got up and he went into the city. And we're saying, what in the world is going on there? Were they bad aims? What? We still don't know. Did he die? Did he not die? We're not sure. Crucifixion could not be botched. And therefore, if in fact, as is the case, Jesus died on a Roman cross, it is beyond bottomlessly ludicrous. Although it's done again and again, it is ludicrous to suggest that he survived that ordeal. He died. And therefore, if he genuinely died, then when he showed himself alive for 40 days, going to the people who had known him well, demonstrating that he was the Nazarene, and they could not question for a moment that he had really died, therefore, it must be true that he has come back from the dead. Now, with this, we're done. Remember I read that verse in John 19 this morning where the Jewish leaders said to Pilate, if you won't crucify him as a seditionist, we have a law, and he ought to die because he claims to be the Son of God. That's why Jesus died. And might I say that it's hard for us to appreciate how difficult Jesus claimed to be the Son of God. We've gotten used to that. But you know what? for a human being to claim to be God come in the flesh is, on the face of it, awful blasphemy. It's blasphemy worthy of death by Mosaic law, unless it just happens to be the truth. And never before in human history had it been the truth. And Jesus had claimed again and again that it was the truth concerning him. How does God prove true a man's claim to be a divine messenger and thus the authority of his message? By miracle. What's the greatest miracle in all of human history? It happened when that Nazarene walked out of the tomb after 3 days. What is it that renders that miracle beyond peradventure, beyond challenge? It's the fact that he died by being lifted up. He died a death that cannot be challenged. And therefore, he came alive from the tomb. Now put it together. John 19:7, you ought to kill him because we have a law and he claimed to be the Son of God. That's a bottomlessly difficult claim, but it's the truth. Put that together with Romans 1, verse 4. He was declared to be the Son of God. You know the word that Paul uses there for declared is our word horizon, horizo. And I like to picture it that way. It was spread across the horizon from earth to sky, from east to west. It was blazoned across the horizon in such a way that nobody can deny it. Nobody can miss it. He was declared to be the Son of God with power. How? By the resurrection from the dead. The reality of Jesus' claims, terribly, terribly difficult claims concerning himself, the reality of those claims is proven true by the resurrection. And the resurrection is rendered absolutely undeniable because Jesus died a death that is undeniable. And therefore, if I be lifted up, then I will draw him into myself. Your faith is grounded in history. The single most important historical truth claim of the Bible is that Jesus came alive from the dead, and the death that he died was designed to make that claim absolutely unassailable and dependable. Father, thank you again for your love to us and for the gift of your Son. We are surrounded in so many ways, and we grow altogether too careless about them. We are surrounded in so many ways by evidences of your goodness and what a loving and gracious and careful God you are. But above all of those, above all of that, there is this. You have sent your Son. And he lived a life which we never could have lived. And it was a life of sinlessness. And he died a death that we never could have died. It was an innocent death. And he paid a price that we never could have paid. And now, Father, all of that is proven true by the fact that he has come back from the dead. We celebrate that, we honor you, and we rejoice in the gift of salvation that we find in your Son. In his name, amen.